And we were kind of talking about how we might prep or not prep for the show. We didn't prep,
no,
by the way.
You couldn't tell, style. Could you? Bob's wearing pants. He prepped.
What are you talking about? I had two bourbons before the show.
Off-Gassing, a scuba podcast with host Nick Hogle. Good dive buddies usually turn into great friendships, and this group is no exception. In this roundtable discussion, I sit down with Bob, the Dude, Larson, Terry, Big T, Irvine, and Jeff, Hefe Lindsay. Sit back, grab a drink, and enjoy as they share some funny stories, lifelong memories, and knowledge about diving in the Great Lakes. Please enjoy. Today, I am excited. We are having a roundtable about Great Lakes wreck diving, and I have some great guests. A couple of guests have been on the podcast before, and a new guest, which I'm very excited to introduce, but I'll go around, let everybody introduce themselves. We'll do Bob, Jeff, or Hefe, and then Terry, Big T.
All right. Well, Bob Larson, diver on the Great Lakes. I spent like the last 12, 13 years running charters on the lakes. And now I'm past couple of years, I've just gotten back into diving with my buddies, and we're doing some pretty cool big dives and having a good time with it.
Jeff Lindsay, longtime diver on the Great Lakes, born and raised there, exiled to the US now, but they let me back in once in a while. So yeah.
Well, my name's Terry Irvine, AKA Big T. And I've been diving on the Great Lakes for about, I guess this was my 36th season on the lakes this year. So it's been a good run, and you know, I've had the opportunity to dive with these two guys quite a bit. Not as much as I'd like, but as much as I can. So thanks for having me back, Nick.
Yeah. No, great to have this group on. I'm excited. I apologize. I know the routine. I just have my coffee. But what is everybody drinking tonight, or today, I should say? Tonight.
What do you got, Bob?
Well, I am drinking a nice bourbon from Garrison Brothers in my Great Lakes glass here. Enjoying that.
And I've got the Boddington's Pub Ale, one of my favorites.
And I'm kind of wimped out. I just got the Diet Canada Dry, so.
Lean and mean.
Yeah.
Big T, you get a pass.
Thank you.
I just got my coffee. Just curious, have you had any Texas bourbon? I know that's kind of bourbon.
I am drinking a Texas bourbon.
Oh, okay. Garrison Brothers. I don't know if I want to say, I don't know if I've had that actually.
I think it's a newer one.
Oh, okay. Have you seen there's a documentary out there called Neat. Have you seen that documentary?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a good one. So a funny thing, after that documentary, we were trying to get the bonded, correct? That's what they call it when it's bonded.
Yes.
Yeah. We were trying to go for the bonded bourbons to try to like step up our, you know, just step up our bourbon game, basically, me and my girlfriend. And we like to drink, obviously. So it got to a point where we'd be like, oh, okay, you know, the bonded stuff is a little bit more expensive. So we'd go out and buy a bottle and be like, okay, well, you know, we'll just kind of sip on this. And then it'd be like 2 days later, the bottle's gone.
Can relate to that, dude.
We need to stop doing this sort of thing. And then TX bourbon, and then just some other random ones were kind of our go-to. But enough about me. So tell me about some Great Lakes wreck diving. So Bob, you said you were getting back into it. What was the last dive trip you guys did together?
Oh, well, I think boys, you got to correct me if I'm wrong, but the last trip we did together was over the summer on the Bradley.
It was the Bradley. Were all there.
Yeah. I mean, that was probably the biggest one any of us have done. And that's how we finished out the Great Lakes this year.
Yep.
Yeah, Carl Bradley was, that's a pinnacle dive there. It was a good one.
Tell me a bit about it.
Well, I think Hef can explain it best. He puts it better than I do.
Before we get into the details of the shipwreck, I want to talk about how we got there and what we assumed we could do versus what we actually did, right? Because we had planned 6 days diving. out on the Bradley. Geez. We thought 6-day window. Now we knew it's out in the middle of Lake Michigan. There's no shelter. So it's a bit dicey. We thought, well, out of 6 days, maybe we'll get 3 or 4 days, right? Well, long story short, we got yeah. 1 day. Day three is what we got. And that was it. But when we got out there, the dude, or Bob, he's the dude to me. He'll always be the dude.
We all got nicknames.
Yeah, the dude and Steve put a line on it. So I'm forever thankful to those guys, because unlike a lot of shipwrecks that you think of where you pull up and it's moored and you go down the line and have a dive and come back up, you need to locate the Bradley. There's no mooring lines on it. And we're, what, 40 kilometers, 20, 25 miles, something like that offshore?
Yeah, we're 25 miles offshore.
So we're a long ways out. The water's deep. We don't know exactly where the wreck is. We've got numbers. But when we get to it, well, then we need to put a mooring line on it. And that's what the dude and Steve did. So I'll let you take it from there. But I think that was pretty epic that you guys sacrificed.
Well, I think getting the mooring on was quite the challenge. First, we had to not only locate the shipwreck, it's how, what is it, 660 feet long, roughly, somewhere around there. And we wanted to dive the bow. So we had to not only locate the wreck, we had to locate the bow. So I drove the boat. I got us over. We got the shot line dropped right on the bow. Actually, I'm not going to claim that I'm this good because I'm really not, but we dropped it about 2 feet from our ideal tie-in point, and then the dive started, and we went down, and we were able to get the line tied into it. Problem being is, you know, when the shot hit the wreck hasn't been dove. It's not like a lot of wrecks that people are diving, you know, every year, year after year. There's dozens of people on it. This one, we figure it had been 10 to 12 years since it had seen a diver, and it was covered in silt. At that point, you're a little over 300 feet and in zero visibility. And so you got to locate it, the line, then get the chain apart and tie it in to where you wanted to and something secure. And we basically did that at right around 300 feet and zero.
So this is the civilized world, Bob. You got to speak metric. No one knows what the hell feet is.
I don't know how deep in metric we did this. I don't know, 1,000, 100, I'm not sure.
Let's call it 15 kilometers, okay?
Listen, I speak in American.
You like so. You speak American, do you?
I speak American.
Just a question, because I'm not sure. Obviously, I know the term shot line, and I apologize for my ignorance, but when you're dropping a shot line, is it basically you're just kind of dropping an anchor?
So basically what we had was we just run a small line with a weight on it to throw over to the boat to sink, and then we take a mooring line down, because in this case we wanted to leave a mooring line on it, because, you know, in our head we were coming back there the next day and the next day and the next day. So our plan was to put a line on, so then the next day there was no screwing around. We could head right to the wreck, get on it, and go diving. That was our plan. So actually, I believe the way we did it this time was we made the mooring line, that the like 3/4 inch poly line, and we put a big weight on the end of that, and we threw that over, had it floating at the surface and the line all the way down to the wreck. And then I undid the weight, tied us in using the chain to the wreck, and then the weight that we had on it, what we usually do is we take out our marker buoy. We tie that onto the weight and shoot it up. When the boat sees the marker buoy at the surface, you know, it's standing upright because it has a weight on it. They pick that up, and that signals to them that they can go over to the other end of the line and tie the boat in. They got time, because the time it took us to do it, we had a couple hours of decompression. So we were, you know, they didn't have to hurry. So they just had to pick that up and then go tie us in. It seemed to work pretty well.
It worked great for us. I mean, you guys got screwed out of a dive on the Bradley, but thank you.
Well, I mean, we got on the wreck, but I didn't get to see it like you guys did.
So Hefe, I think to help Nick, I think it'd be cool to kind of give a little bit of history of the Bradley, but also talk about the condition of it and the depth of it, because it really it adds weight to what Bob did. And then the photos that Hefe took once he got down on it, and we were, you know, we got a dive on it. So I don't know, Hefe, you have more knowledge of the Bradley than the rest of us. So why don't just kind of give us a bit of a description there?
Yeah, sure. On my computer beside me, I have some notes, so I'm not going to pretend I know this much about it, but it happens to be right here. I'm glad you asked. Let's see. It was 639 feet long, and it was the flagship of the Bradley Transportation Company. So when it was built, it was the largest ship on the lake. It was built in 1927, and it sailed until 1958. So this was a big ship. So what's 640 feet in meters? It's a lot. I don't know, Nick, help me out.
Two hundred some meters.
I don't know. Anyways, it's November 18th, 1958. The crew thinks they're totally done for the season. They've delivered the last load of stone and they're headed to winter layup. So in the Great Lakes, they freeze up and the shipping comes to an end and everybody gets couple months off to go home and have Christmas and see the family, and that's the sailor's time off, right? So it's November and they think everything's awesome, job done, let's go to port. They know the ship is a bit, it needs repairs, and so that it's going to get repaired when it gets to port over the winter season. And they're almost back to where they're going to winter for the season. They get a call to say, well, we got one more load of stone. The prices are really good right now. Head back to home port, pick up a load of stone and go deliver it somewhere. So they have to change course. They're still on Lake Michigan, but then all of a sudden the storm that they figured they were going to dodge hits really hard. And they've got like seas running 15 meters, 40 feet. And this 640 foot ship simply just split. It broke its back, they call it. And it broke in the middle, and within a few minutes, the ship was gone. They sent out a mayday. And again, this is November. The water is ice cold. It's just above freezing. It's actually the air temperature is below freezing, so water is freezing on the ship. There was a crew of 35. Only two survived. Four made it to the life raft immediately after everybody abandoned ship. So there was four that survived, four that made it to the life raft. And then I think it was 7 hours for help to arrive, and only two remained alive because it was just so cold, right? And so that's how, unfortunately, a crew of 35 ended up losing their ship. But yeah, that's the Bradley. So it's a massive steel ship. It looks a lot like the freighters that still sail the lakes today, which is it really surprises me.
Well, and I believe it's the second largest wreck in the Great Lakes.
It's the second largest wreck in the Great Lakes itself.
Next to the fifth.
It's the largest diveable shipwreck. So the Edmund Fitzgerald's a little bit bigger, but it's off limits to diving. It's a protected heritage site for whatever reason. It's different. There's a lot of rules there. But the Bradley is not. But yeah, it's the largest diveable shipwreck on the Great Lakes. So it's pretty special. We've been wanting to do it for a long time.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Why is it just because the depth of it's not dived as much because it's such a task to get to?
Well, I think the depth has a lot to do with it. Definitely does, because that really limits the amount of qualified divers, the depth, the cold, the amount of decompression you have to do, and just the logistics of getting there. Like we said, we had 6 days planned up there and we were lucky we got that one day in. So it's in a fairly remote location, so it's not somewhere easy to get to. Just the harbor, there's not a lot of places to stay. It's not really much of a town. There's, one or two restaurants, and that's about it. And little tiny harbor. I mean, we were basically pulling the boat every night and boarding at the launch ramp. It's just logistically, it's a tough one to do. And then, you know, you take that into account with the depths and the cold and all that, and it's not dove very often.
Yeah, and that's the key thing for me is the temperature. Like, you hear people diving shipwrecks in, you know, the 110, 120 meter range all the time, right, Nick? Like, it's not a big deal to do the Britannic. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's a big deal to do the Britannic, and you know, but you're dealing with water that's, what's the temperature in the Britannic, like 25°C, 28°C? Like, it's warm, right, top to bottom. I think once we broke through 10, 15 meters, temperature here would be 3, maybe 4°C. So the whole dive, you're in that kind of water until you get back to that thermocline. So think about that. You're in 100 plus meters dealing with temperature that's just above zero. Right. So, I mean, that there's a level there that it compounds the challenge that you're doing. So it's out there. It's a challenge. Yeah.
We look at 15, 20 minutes on the shipwreck. I mean, now you're talking 2+ hours to get out of the water. So you got to plan, can I take this cold that long? That really comes into account, you know?
I think we all feel like when we're on the dive, like, do you guys feel the cold when you're actually on the bottom? Because I don't. I'm too busy.
You did on the Moonlight in Lake Superior.
Well, yeah, when the suit floods, that's a bit different. Yeah. But when everything's going good, if I have water that's 1°C pouring in on my crotch, I feel that right away. Luckily, that didn't happen on the Bradley. And everything's good. But to Bob's point, like when you finish the dive, you leave the bottom, right? Then you've got an hour and a half, 2 hours of deco ahead of you. That's when the work starts. It really gets cold quickly.
Yeah.
At that point, you're probably heated vests, things like that. Like you almost need to, correct? Like I'm a...
Yeah, we don't go in without those anymore. That's been the best invention to help Great Lakes divers is the heated gear we wear. You know, I have the gloves. I love them. It's a game changer.
Yeah. Like I got a heated suit, the whole undersuit heated, and it makes a world of difference.
Not only the heated suit, but I know at some point we're going to talk about this anyway. So I think the use of the migration that we did from open circuit doubles and stages to the rebreather has been a huge game changer for us as well. On the dive that we did on the Bradley, we had to carry a lot of bailout gas because we had to plan for that contingency. But we're also breathing a lot warmer air. We're breathing nice, moist, warm air. And, in times when we've had to bail out, we didn't notice the difference right away on the difference in temperature. Now you're breathing refrigerated air every breath. So it's certainly the rebreather has helped us with some of these deeper dives.
Very much.
Over the last 5 years, say.
I'm really digging the Barry White voice you got going there, T-Man. I see the cold is hanging on.
Yeah, I've had a cold for 2 weeks, so yeah, this is my radio voice.
Sexy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, how did you all meet?
They showed up on my boat and I couldn't get rid of them.
Didn't we meet in prison? I thought we were all in jail at the same time.
No, that was another time.
That was someone else.
So I know Jeff and I have always talked about, we can't really remember exactly when we met. I remember a dive trip back in 2003 that we did together in the lower Great Lakes, and we were diving in Lake Ontario, and it was sport diving depths, but we had incredible visibility because I think we had it was a cold winter, if I remember, but we had visibility in the lower Great Lakes in June that was 120 feet easy, and Jeff was shooting video, and I think I was shooting video as well, and we kind of hit it off right from there, and then we started going cave diving together, and we didn't meet Bob till a little bit later on, and, you know, we spent almost 30 years, and we never touched Lake Michigan. We never went to Milwaukee. We never did anything like Michigan. We kind of, we got the other ones. We're good, and then the first trip we went to Milwaukee, we met Bob, and that changed our perspective completely. We fell in love with Lake Michigan, that whole area, Chicago, Milwaukee. And of course, you know, he's the dude. You can't not like the dude.
The dude abides.
That was, I think, Bob, that was, I think it was 2014 that I met you, because 2015 I was on the machine. So that's how I remember. Yeah. That was my second year.
Yeah, you were on open circuit when we started diving.
Yeah.
And I don't know, every year since then. And then I backed off on the charters. And I got a little story that T-Man did. I was ready to kind of take a break from diving. You know, I needed my time away from it for a little bit. And T was over at my house for a visit. And he's trying to convince me to go cave diving. And I've been cave diving for many years, but I said, I don't know. And he's pushing me to go. And I had gotten rid of a previous rebreather and I had bought a new one, but I hadn't used it much. And I said, well, I'll go on the trip with you, but I'm going open circuit. And he says, okay, 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 sounds good. Next thing I know, we're at the house and Big T's going through my rebreather, figuring out what I need for it. Next day when he gets home, he tells me he already picked up the parts. It's ready to go. Just bring it to Florida. You're diving that. And next thing I know, we were in Eagle's Nest that week. So here I was ready to kind of hang it up for a bit and take a break. And T-Man decided otherwise. And I'm very glad you did that. And we've been doing a lot of big dives ever since. It's been a lot of fun.
When Big T makes a phone call, you answer.
Well, that sort of developed the unofficial Team Revo for the Midwest, didn't it?
I think it did. Yeah, we are the unofficial Team Revo. We can't get anybody to actually sponsor us.
Did you buy a machine yet, Nick? I know last time we spoke, you were thinking about it.
This year it will happen this year. I actually did get to do a tri dive on a Revo. I did a tri dive on a Liberty, and then a Liberty side mount, and then a Choptima. And I did like the Revo the most, because the instructor that I'm working with, the one I actually got drunk on the podcast,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's the guy to go with.
It was a fun recording. Although, like I said, just the next day, just kind of that like little slight hangover listening to myself, like, did I really say that?
You just deleted the whole thing, didn't you?
Oh, it's released to the public, heavily edited, but released to the public. I think I even make an apology at the beginning of the podcast. Like, yeah, I got a little drunk. Rum and me don't mix great sometimes. But no, so this year it will happen because the kind of like you're saying, just going from open circuit to closed, the advantages. So after I finished a course, the ANDP course, I started looking at obviously mixed gas. I think it's kind of a natural progression going into helium. And a lot of talk was just kind of thrown at me like, if you're going to go that route, you might as well go the rebreather because it's just cost these days, things like that. So
well, at this point, it's cost prohibitive to dive open circuit trimix. I mean, the cost of the class for all the training dives you're going to do paid for your buying a machine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting that expensive now.
Yeah. And that's especially out here in Southeast Asia. It's definitely just not cheap. So that's why I started looking into it. But the unit is not bought yet, but there will be at some point this year. I'm actually headed to Mexico later this year in about 2 months to start my overhead training. So So I'm venturing into that.
Good for you.
Tell me a little bit about the charter you ran. You said you just took a break, Bob, but you ran one for a few or more than a few years.
So I ran a charter majority of the time was out of Milwaukee. Milwaukee's a great area for diving because, you know, I can put you on a wreck in 20 feet of water or in 300 feet of water. And for the most part, everything is within 6 or 7 miles of the harbor. So there's no long runs. We can run 2 trips a day, get 4 dives in every day. Unless we start doing night dives, then we can do more. It was really great. And I would have groups that would come in. You know, they'd come in for a week at a time. And not only were we able to, you know, go diving, I was able to take the groups out and show them the city and show them, you know, different bars and restaurants and things to do. And, you know, I'd have groups like these guys when they'd come up. I think you guys always hoped we'd get at least one weather day just so we could all go out and do things. So, you know, I ran a 6-pack boat. I really preferred to run more technical charters than recreational charters. Just my opinion, the caliber of diver we had was a lot less headache for me. You know, the recreational divers got very repetitive and required a lot of work, where the technical divers, for the most part, I could pull up and say, okay, go, get off the boat, and we're done.
So, dude, I got to interrupt. Can you tell us a couple stories? Come on. Tell us some stories about your favorite charters and dealing with cold water. Come on. People are going to love this.
These guys know all the stories, so Hef, why don't you just pick one tell me where to start? Which one would you like to hear first?
Diaper Boy is pretty good. Can we hear about Diaper Boy?
Oh, my God. This guy goes out and he buys himself a brand new semi-dry wetsuit. Okay, semi-dry, not a dry suit. It's a semi-dry. The way a semi-dry wetsuit works, water gets into your suit, and then it stays inside your suit. And your body warms it up, and that keeps you warm. Well, he didn't want to pee in his new suit, and so he didn't want it to smell. So he decided it would be a good idea that he wore a diaper underneath his new semi-dry suit, forgetting that the water has to come in. So that little blue absorbent stuff that's inside those diapers, I know what color it is, because trust me, I'll get there in a sec. It absorbs all the water. When he got on the boat, I had one rule. No wet clothes inside the cabin. You change, you get your stuff off outside. Well, this guy walked into the cabin, peeled his semi-dry suit off, and his diaper exploded. And this shit went everywhere. A year later, I was still finding it in the little nooks and crannies on the boat. This guy had stuff everywhere. Now, I did make him clean it all up. And he's like, what? It's not my boat. I said, well, if you want to get back to the harbor, you're going to clean it up. That was part of my problem the last couple of years. I was a little harsh with some of the divers.
It was deserved, yeah.
Well, they deserved it. I think as far as customer service goes, there might have been better options. There's a few of those in particular, but...
But I can remember you explaining to him, like, look, you can't wear a diaper under a semi-dry suit.
Yeah.
All right.
But they tell me I don't know what I'm talking
about. Prove me wrong. Okay.
And, I mean... Why would I know? You know, I'm just, I was a recreational and technical instructor, rebreather diver, cave diver, trying to exhaust, and they're telling me I don't know what I'm talking about. So, okay, prove me wrong. And then they blow up a diaper all over. And then they're upset that I made them clean it up. So, yeah, there was that one. That was a fun one. I had another guy. I don't want to get too specific, but he was... Midwest cave diver. We do have caves here in the Midwest. And he came up to dive with us in the lakes in early May.
Really cold.
Early May, it's really cold. Really cold. So the guy's gearing up and he's getting ready to get in. And I notice he has the fingers cut off all his gloves. I say, hey, man, come here. Hold on. Don't go yet. Let me grab a pair of gloves for you. He tells me, don't tell me what to do. I'm a cave diver. This is how we do things. I said, well, that's cool, man. I'm a cave diver too, but you're not cave diving. It's May and you're in the Great Lakes. I will give you a pair of gloves. He repeats himself not to tell him what to do. Okay, go. It was probably 8 minutes later.
No, I don't think that's what you said. I think you may have added a few expletives to that.
Well, trying to not say fuck too much.
To go help him off the boat. He could go forth and multiply.
So, yes. So he gets off the boat. It was under 8 minutes later. He's at the back of the boat, and he's shaking. He's so cold. And I said, well, get on the boat. He says, I can't grab the ladder. I said, look, I don't know. That's what you cave divers do. I thought this is how things go. And he never came back. I had to drag him up on the boat because his hands wouldn't move to grab the ladder. You know, I mean, but again, what do I know?
God, it's cold.
Great Lakes, May? Yeah, who needs gloves? I mean, there's a lot of that. And again, that's why I like to more pick and choose my groups. These guys got on the boat. This was not a charter with them. It was just... Hey, let's just go diving and have a good time. I'll stay on the boat. And that was it. We just would have a blast.
I know, Nick, when we talk about Great Lakes diving, I know there's certainly a perception that, you know, it's freezing cold all the time. And, you know, there really isn't any Great Lakes dive that we do that we're not either in a full dry suit with full dry gloves. So, you know, we're not trying to dismiss that as a myth. But you know, we get strategic and we start off the season usually in the lower lakes, Lake Ontario, maybe Lake Erie, do a bit of diving there. And we work our way up so that we hit Superior usually by August. So we're, and if we're up there in August, we'll get temperatures of, you know, 55, 60 degrees from 40 feet up. And that's where we really need it. You know, when we're doing our 20-foot stops, hanging out there for 45 minutes, an hour, you know, we make ourselves sound tougher than we really are sometimes. But, you know, certainly it is cold water diving. And, you know, nobody that's doing it seriously, certainly nobody doing technical, would do anything other than, you know, dry suit with full undergarments and typically heated undergarments, you know, like we've talked about. But I think what, you know, when we do this, if you look at some of Jeff's photos, you know, we've been starting to get better visibility. You know, Lake Michigan is phenomenal. The photos that Jeff took on the Bradley, you know, he's at 320 feet and, you know, he's getting back and getting shots with a wide angle lens, a fisheye lens. That's unbelievable. So it's, if you like shipwreck diving, the Great Lakes is certainly a great place to come and explore. You know, and all the wrecks, everything is fresh water, so everything is preserved. It's an exciting spot to dive.
So like T said, we try not to go too far north early, but there was that one year we got suckered into going to Lake Superior in June. I think you remember that, T. And I can clearly remember my computer's reading. It read 1 degree on the bottom, and on the surface, it was 2 degrees. So we doubled our temperature, but 2C on the surface is... that's challenging. That's tough. I'm still trying to warm up.
Yeah, the year we dove, we found the boxcar when we were looking for CPR 694. That previous year, Lake Superior had frozen to within 93% over the winter. And so we're up diving it in August, the year we found the boxcar. And we did not hit a thermocline until we were in 14 feet of water. So we were literally just kind of trying to get up as high to the surface as we could just to get, you know, get a few extra degrees out. And it was one of the most uncomfortable dives from a decompression standpoint. And it was right after that dive. That was the last dive I did in Lake Superior in open circuit. I decided I was either going to quit Trimix diving or I was going to move to a rebreather. And following year, I was on a rebreather.
Jeff, just a quick question, or Hefe. what are the challenges of like photography when the water's that cold? Because I would assume, or I don't know much about underwater photography other than looking at pictures, but I would assume that there's probably quite a bit of challenges going into that, the colder the water.
You just need a really good camera. That's what he does.
Just use AI. Don't even go diving. Just let AI do it all. Don't worry about it. No. So before I answer that question, Rick, these other two guys are both phenomenal photographers as well. So they may say they're not, but I've seen what they do. So they're both very good. But
well, when we're talking with the best photographer in the Great Lakes.
Oh, shit.
It's hard to compare.
Yeah. What are the challenges? For me, the biggest challenge would be just the gear, like the dry gloves. So you really need to know your camera. You'll be in a spot where you just need to know where all the buttons and controls are, right? You really can't see it that well. It's pretty dark at times. You've got big, thick gloves on. You're trying to strike a balance between keeping your hands from turning blue and being able to feel the controls. So you got to find out what works for you in terms of thermal protection for your hands. But the best part by far diving the Great Lakes with a camera is there's no rinse needed. It's been rinsed for 3 hours when you come back, so it's totally good to go. Just pack it away and it's great. But no, it's what about you guys? Do you find any challenges with your cameras?
No, I think you pretty much nailed it. It's just a lot, you know, it's a lot of extra gear. We're already carrying a lot of gear for these dives that we do. And now you're throwing that in. And, you know, one of the things I really enjoy, and Hefe is not going to believe me, I actually like not taking my camera and taking lights for Hefe.
I don't.
And I enjoy that. I really do. He doesn't like asking people to run lights for him, but I enjoy doing that. And, I mean, he's a better photographer than I am. I fully admit that. And I like helping him get those good shots. And I think for me, that's a lot of the fun.
I've seen your photos of the Rosenko in outside of Chicago. I thought that was pretty awesome. So,
all right, I'm working on it.
I think, dude, that's a really good point, though. Nick, one of the things, because Hefe and the dude and I dive together a lot, and because we've all been behind the camera and been model, we certainly probably have better underwater communication than certainly if I'm diving with somebody outside of this group. When we were diving the Bradley per se, you know, I was Hefe's model. I was one of a couple models that Hefe had, but we kind of intuitively know. We know where Jeff wants to go. A lot of times we'll try to get ourselves set up, you know, the offboard lighting, so on. And it certainly, it helps because it takes a while to get that shot set up. And one of the things we find when we're diving with people that either are not photographers or not models, we might take 10 minutes to set up the shot that Jeff really wants. And, you know, we've dove with people that one click and, you know, they've moved on. So
I think I've said it before previously with you, Nick, like it really sucks being a model, right? Like it's the worst thing to hang out for a photographer because I'll camp out in a spot and I'll expect the model to stay there with me for the next half hour. Well, who wants to do that, right? It's the worst thing ever to dive with a photographer.
Oh, no, the worst time it is when you're in Lake Huron and you have a completely flooded dry suit on the Spangler and your photographer, you give him a thumbs up and say, let's go. And he says, no, just a few more around the stern. Okay.
Yeah, but look at the photos. I mean, you're memorialized for posterity, dude. Photos of you on the Spangler. I know Karen loves those photos.
With the duct tape holding my neck seal together.
Yeah. Karen tells me how much she loves those photos of you.
Yeah. Hefe will tell you that being a model's awful. It's completely awful until you get a, you know, super awesome photo that you're hanging on your wall that you're looking at as we're doing a podcast. You know, it's
I can think of a few I got hanging up here.
I was down Boosting O2 today and I got my photo. There's a photo that Jeff took of me on the bow of the Judge Hart. And the Judge Hart is a small freighter up in Lake Superior and is certainly one of my top five wrecks. And every time I see that, you know, takes me back to some awesome dives we've done on that wreck and in that lake. So it's, you know, the work is certainly worth the reward for sure.
So that reminds me, Big T, why don't you tell us the differences between the lakes, specifically why Lake Superior is so different than the other four?
But the big thing with Superior is, you know, again, there's usually no surprise that Superior tends to be the one I like the most, but Superior is the only one of the Great Lakes now that still hasn't got the invasion of the mussels, quagga mussels, the zebra mussels. So when we're diving wrecks up in Lake Superior, the visibility will always be less than what we would see, say, in Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, but the detail is there. So if we're diving, you know, Jeff has some photos of the Comet in Whitefish Point, and you can see the paint very clearly on the boiler. And, you know, when we do the Judge Hart sank in November 1942, you can read out the name Judge Hart very clearly on the fantail. There's no mussels on it or anything like that. So all the detail is there. And that's, you know, unfortunately, that's one of the things we miss in the other lakes is we've lost that detail. We have much better visibility, so we're able to capture more of the wreck in its entirety, or certainly, you know, a larger scope, but we miss the detail. So it depends. With, you know, with the Bradley, you know, we gave that up so we could get better visibility and you can get a sense of the scope and the size of the wreck. But, you know, each lake has its own unique flavor, I guess.
I think most of you guys could probably look at a photo and tell what lake it was taken in, even if you don't know the wreck. Like, I think I can. Yeah, they each look different.
I think you're I'd be pretty close.
Yeah, Michigan, you know, it was funny, as I say, you know, we didn't start exploring Lake Michigan, at least Jeff and I, till later in our career. But, it, you know, we kind of regret that now. You know, there's so much cool stuff out in the Midwest, and we've certainly, you know, we met the dude that way, but we met a whole group of divers in the Midwest that they're way more active than, you know, any group that I have in my area near Toronto, you know, and just, they're a great bunch of people to hang with. They all show up to play and it's easy.
Prodigious drinkers as well, too. Yeah. No, not Bob.
What are you talking about? Not me.
I gave that up for Lent.
Is there any plans to try to make it back to the Bradley?
Oh, man. The dates didn't line up for me. You might go. I don't know.
There's talks for next year, isn't there? Oh, wait. Or is that on or off? I don't even remember now. There is plans to go back.
Yeah.
We're working on it. We're working out dates. We're trying to figure it out. I think we got some unfinished stuff to do on that one.
I've got unfinished business with the Bradley. We only saw a fraction of it. So there's another 600 feet I want to see of the Bradley. So I'd love to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We got plans to get back there. I actually hope that maybe this year we can get the numbers for the Ironton.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Out in Lake Huron. That's one, you know, we've spent the last couple of years diving the Ohio out there. And the Ironton's another one. It's the one that collided with it, I believe, right? And it's nearby, but we have not located it, but NOAA has. They're just not releasing the numbers yet. So we're hoping that this year we can actually acquire the numbers and get out on that one. That would be another big one.
The Ohio's pretty special.
Tell me a little bit about the wreck.
Do you want to, Bob, or do you want me to do it?
Nope. You got it, Hef.
Well, let me just take a look at my computer over here, and I'll talk about the Ohio. Let's see. It was built in 1874. It was lost in 1894. It was a little over 60 meters long. It was it's a wooden cargo ship, and what else? It was had a single steam engine in it. Was located in 2017 inside the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. We dove it in 2022, 2023, and it rests in about 90 meters, I think is where it sits. But I will say about this, the visibility we had in 2022 on the Ohio was...
Oh, my God.
I don't know. What would it be, Bob? I bet you it was probably, I think, at least 150-foot visibility.
200 feet?
Conservatively. That was on the short side, yeah. So
easily. And that was the trip. We had a plan to go out there. We were out there 6-7 days, and we had planned to dive 4 or 5 different wrecks. I think we spent like 5 days on the Ohio.
Yeah, we were going to go all over and see this wreck and that wreck. And then I think after the first dive on the Bradley, the whole team was like, screw that. On the Ohio. We're going to stay on the Ohio.
And I think after 3 days, we said, oh, that's 3 300s in a row. Let's take a break. We brought it down to like a 200-foot dive for a day, and then we went right back to the 300.
Right back to the Ohio. but yeah, the Ironton collided with the Ohio, and in about 30 minutes, both of them sunk. And like I say, the Ohio was located in 2017, and it was released to the public, and we dove it in 22, 23. But they never released the numbers for the Ironton. Which was located in 2019. Maybe this will be the year. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Why do they hold on to the numbers? Like, is it like if they find it?
It's a good question.
I got a huge problem with that because it's a publicly funded organization, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They went out, they found it, but they're not releasing the numbers. So I would think unless there's some national security issue, they should release it. I don't get it. But yeah. I would love to get photos of that one too, and we could kind of bookend the story between the two shipwrecks because you could clearly see in the Ohio where the Ironton hit it right at its stern section. There's a huge V notch right in the side of the ship, and I would just love to see what the bow of the Ironton looks like and get some photos of it and then kind of complete this story 150 years later.
Is that a normal thing to keep like a not release numbers or keep shipwrecks basically like if someone finds it, they don't want other people to know about it. Why is that?
Go ahead, Bob.
You know, I don't know. I'm working on a couple right now that I may have located. And I'll tell you right now, once I've confirmed them, I'm not sharing the numbers. And I don't know why. It's just the way things are here with private shipwreck hunters. Now, like he said, this is a government agency that found it that's funded by taxpayers. That should be out to the public. But, you know, a lot of these wrecks, you know, we have friends who go out and find them. And, you know, as close of friends as we are with them, they may have found 10 different wrecks and they might share one or two. And then a couple of years later, they'll say, hey, here's the numbers for this one. Go here. And it's just kind of the way it's been. Not that it's right. It's just the way that it's been. And the one I'm working on now, I want my friends to dive it. I want all my friends to dive it, photograph it, do all that before anybody else. So I'm not sharing it. And when we're all done with it, then I don't care.
I like your style, Bob.
Yeah, I think Nick, part of that's driven by, you know, a lot of the shipwreck hunters that are going out and just spending weekends upon weekends with a tow fish. And they put tremendous hours, tremendous resources. They're putting fuel in their boat. So they put a lot into these, you know, the shipwreck hunting. And so I think, you know, as Bob said, for the first couple of years, a lot of it's just, we found it, let us go and explore it. There's eventually most of these wrecks do get released in one form or another. You know, I think about the Manitou that was found in 18. You know, we kind of had exclusivity of it for a couple of seasons before the numbers really became public, but they did, you know, they did become public at a certain point, and, you know, people are diving it. And, you know, depending on the shipwreck, sometimes what'll happen is, like the Manitou is a great example of a very delicate shipwreck that from 2018 to now, we're seeing damage on it already with like 5 years of diving on it with people that are, you know, technically trained and, you know, supposed to have good buoyancy control. But, you know, we're hearing things like, you know, the guys think it's cool to run up the stairwell with a scooter and rips a railing off. So it's, you know, we are seeing some of that happening, and it will happen. You know, not all divers are responsible divers, unfortunately. And that's just the way of things.
And that kind of goes back to trying to get photos of it pretty quickly. Like, I'm pretty proud of what we did on the Manitou. We've got some really early photos there that kind of capture the condition of it. And I would dearly love to get to the Ironton to go get some photos of that kind of in the as found condition and see what it looks like before people get on it. So, yeah, maybe that's selfish. I don't know, but I'd like to show it to people. So I don't know. Maybe it isn't.
But I think as a group, you know, what's kind of interesting because Nick's question, you know, I think a lot of us, I think the three of us have always been, you know, we want to be more inclusive than exclusive most of the times. You know, we love diving wrecks and we want other people to enjoy diving them as well. You know, there is a downside to that, but, you know, I think certainly Hefe and I are like that. And I think Bob is too, that, you know, once we've found something that, you know, is really cool, you know, we found the terrain, we wanted to get as many people diving the terrain as we could, you know, and I think it's important for us to share that.
You were one of the first people, Big T, on the Severns, right? The Severns? Severns? How do you say that?
Yeah, Severns. So that was, yeah, Ken gave us the numbers for that, more or less. And, so we had an opportunity. And, you know, that particular wreck, it was a package freighter, and it sank immediately when it backed off the dock. It hit a rock backing off the dock. And so it was completely loaded with all kinds of items. There was, you know, ceramic jars filled with food. There's all kinds of plates. Like, we literally move piles of dishes out of the way to look at something else. There's so much, but it sank so easily and so gently. You know, there's the galley. We can actually go right into the galley and get, you know, I got a shot. All the dishes are neatly in the shelves. Everything is there. And so that's so cool to see that. And we want to share that with other people. But, you know, again, even with that one, you know, more people have been diving it as of the last few years, and there has been some damage.
Well, I think that's a big part of the problem. Example is, we have a wreck here out of Chicago, which I know neither of you guys have dove, the Thomas Hume. I was probably one of the fourth or fifth guys ever to dive on that. And it used to be loaded with dishes and pots and pans, and there was some old uniforms and some shoes and stuff in there. But over the years, the numbers have gotten out and gotten public. It's now dove on a regular basis. And I think I was on it again 2-3 years ago. And almost all of that stuff is gone. I will say the charter boats that go out there, there's zero tolerance for taking anything. I mean, you take something off the rack, you're done. You know, not only are you, you're not coming back on that boat. Word gets out, you're not getting on any boat. You can't do that in the Great Lakes. But people get the numbers once they get out, and they take their own little private boat there, and they go shopping for stuff they'd like to put in their garage, and it all disappears. And I think that's another reason why people don't like to give out what they found, is what's going to happen once the public hits it, you know? And it's not necessarily charter operators. It's more guy with his own boat, and he thinks he can get out there and do what he wants. And that's become a problem. At least down here. I don't think we see that as much on the deeper wrecks. We do, but
yeah,
you start getting deeper and there's a different level of diver that it takes to go there. And I think, at least I want to think, they have more respect for the shipwreck and for the history of it to leave what's down there.
I'm just curious, is there a shipwreck that hasn't been found, like the elusive one, the unicorn? I'm sure there's a ton,
loads of them.
But is there one that,
oh yeah,
saw, like the most elusive one, the most one, you know, is there?
Well, the Griffin, the first one. Yeah.
The Griffin, they find it every 2 or 3 years. Somebody claims to have found it. I think the last one turned out to be a telephone pole. There was one, they were claimed they found it, and they were absolutely positive that they had located it, and these divers said they have it and they found the safe from the boat, and it turned out it was a tugboat. Well, the Griffin was built, it's from what, the like early 1500s. It was a wooden ship for exploration. They had never seen these waters. It was not a steel tugboat.
So I'm just Googling the Griffin right now. So I know it was built by LaSalle, who was a French explorer. It was built 1679. So it literally was the first.
1679. There were still no steel tugboats running around. But it, like I said.
No, there was no steel. There was no steel boats on the Great Lakes. So the very first explorers who came to the Great Lakes, they kind of just didn't know what to do. They couldn't sail their ships into the lakes, right? So when they got to something like Lake Erie, they would build a ship. And in this case, the Griffin was built, and they used that to use the existing routes that the native tribes would use to get around the lakes. And so they built this ship, and the French explorer just talked to the natives as he moved north, and they got over to, I don't know, it was near Milwaukee, right? Obviously, Milwaukee wasn't there at that time, but somewhere in that area. And on the return trip, the ship was lost and it's never been found. No one knows where the hell it went. It's gone, right? So it was the first sailing ship on the Great Lakes, and consequently the first shipwreck on the Great Lakes as well too. And to Bob's point, like every couple of years, somebody has found the Griffin, right? That's the most famous.
And they are sure it's the Griffin.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's like 50 people that are guaranteed. They're 100% positive they found the Griffin. So,
And to be perfectly honest, chances are pretty good they ran aground somewhere, the ship broke up, there's nothing left of the ship. I think if you have any chance of finding anything of the Griffin, apparently it's reported that there was one cannon mounted on the bow. That would still be there. If you can find a cannon from that time period, you can say you found something from the Griffin. But I really doubt something, what, 300 some years ago, exploring the lakes, it's likely gone.
Yeah, it wasn't a big ship. It was pretty small, 30 to 40 feet long. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to find that. So, but that would be considered the Holy Grail.
But there's loads of shipwrecks that haven't been found that are still out there. They know they've been lost, but no one knows where they are.
I know we're keen to find the Carruthers.
Carruthers would be one, yeah.
That'd be a good one to find.
Go ahead, T.
It was a freighter. Yeah. Well, you probably know more about it than me. You know, it was a big freighter. Lake Huron somewhere.
So in 1913, there was a really tremendous storm in the fall, November 1913.
Covered all of the lakes.
Yeah, and it was a 3-day storm. So there was a massive first half of the storm, then there was a bit of a lull. So a lot of the people, captains, thought, well, the storm's passed. So they went out into the lakes. And then, of course, the second half of the storm hit, which was even worse than the first. So it was really a hurricane. And it wiped out something like, 30, 40 ships, and over 200 people lost their lives. And these are big freighters. So like 1913, there was freighters sailing around that were 500-600 feet long. Like there's some big ships out there. And the Carruthers was one of them, I believe. If I'm wrong here, guys, correct me, but I think this is right. I'm not Googling this.
So, no, you're right on track.
So yeah, the Carruthers was lost somewhere in Lake Huron. And it's a big ship. I mean, it was 500 feet long, something like that. And to my knowledge, it's never been found unless someone's keeping it secret. But I think it's still on the list of things to find. That would be one.
So just a couple. Well, I guess I feel like I have a last few bit of questions, but I know Terry, you were saying that one of your favorite wrecks is the Judge Hart. But what are some of your favorite wrecks to go out and dive?
This is our age old top five wreck discussion. So let's take a go at that, shall we? I don't know. I think the Kamloops has to be up there in the top five. It's up in Lake Superior off Avrail. The Ginona has to be in the top five.
The Ohio.
Yeah. So you know, there's the new ones come on all the time. You know, so you know, doing the Ohio and doing the Bradley, all of a sudden.
Got to put the Ohio.
What about the Manitou?
Yeah, you know, the Manitou is up there. That's the problem, Nick, is they kind of jockey around, you know, in top five. If we're allowed top 10 or top 20, it's easier discussion. But it's what's kind of interesting is if you think about our favorite wrecks and where they are, we do actually have them kind of nicely dispersed over, you know, there's some in Superior, there's some in Lake Michigan, some in Huron. You know, I think more about favorite spots I like to dive, and certainly up, you know, Presque Isle, which is in Lake Huron, is a favorite haunt of ours. We love going there. There's lots of wrecks there, good conditions, a lot of stuff in around the 200-foot range. Whitefish Point is certainly one of my favorite. That's in southern Lake Superior. And that Whitefish Bay was kind of a natural harbor that people would get out of the weather. So that's, you know, the Fitzgerald sank about 19 miles away from Whitefish Point. But there's all kinds of other stuff anywhere between 140 feet and 300 feet for diveable. And then, of course, the Fitz is up there and 500 and change.
Well, I got to say, as far as favorites, I think you guys might even agree with me somewhat on this one. I don't know if it's my favorite because the ones we mentioned are definitely top five or however many we named. But one of them I really enjoy diving is out of Milwaukee, and it's the Prince Wilhelm.
Yeah.
The Willie, we call it. And, you know, you hit the top of the wreck. She's laying over on her side. It was a Dutch flagged steel freighter. It's 250 foot long. It's all intact. You hit the side of it or the top of the wreck, right? And you're in like 45 feet of water. And when you get down in the cargo holds and start exploring it, you're in 90 feet of water. So You got all day. I mean, you can spend hours and hours and hours on it, and there's so much to see.
Yeah.
And it's 3 miles from shore. So it's a 10-minute boat ride, and you're on a really cool wreck. When I ran charters there, all my technical divers, they hated it. I don't want to go there. And they would tell them, if I put that wreck in 200 feet of water, you would pay me anything I wanted to take you there.
Yeah.
And they would. Because it's really that good and it's accessible. And that is a wreck that gets a lot of people interested in wreck diving and gives them that drive to go further and say, wait, I want to see more stuff like that. What do I have to do? And I think that's a great wreck. It's a lot of fun to dive. I mean, I went out there and spent 3 hours swimming around the wreck. It's just a good time.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Bob. I think, you know, that Liberty ship and the other one I've liked that I've never dove as much as I wanted to is the Monrovia off Alpena. You know, those are two really cool Liberty ships. You know, have some interesting history.
How about the Daniel Morel?
Oh yeah,
I do like the Morel.
Yeah, we get the Morel. Yeah, where's that number yeah. eight?
No, that might be top five.
Yeah, you know what's cool, Nick, is that, you know, and we were kind of talking about how we might prep or not prep for the show. We didn't prep,
no,
by the way.
You couldn't tell, could you? Bob's wearing pants. He prepped.
What are you talking about? I had two bourbons before the show.
But I think the fascinating thing is we have so many shipwrecks that we can go and explore over the five lakes. And we really do feel blessed that we're in the middle of some of the best wreck diving in the world. You know, we'd love to go and do some exploration in the UK. But, you know, Pete Measley is a great example. He loves coming and diving the Great Lakes with us, you know, because it's just, there's a lot of detail. The ships are very well preserved. It's all fresh water. And we recognize how good we have it in terms of wreck diving. And, you know, we're excited to share that. And, you know, with our photography and videos and stuff, that's kind of what we're trying to do, is just, hey, come and hang out with us and do some exploring. It's pretty cool.
I think it's truly the best wreck diving in the world because of the fresh water and because of how the fresh water preserves the shipwrecks. You know, you're not going to find wrecks like this anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I think the Kamloops is a great example. So the Kamloops sank in, what was that, 1927 or 28, somewhere around there. And it was a package freighter, and it sank off Isle Royale. But you can go into the hold. So it had everything from women's shoes to clothing to dry goods. But you can go inside the wreck, and on shelves, there are lifesavers that sank in 1927 that you can get up close and you can get a photo of the name. So the wrapper's still on it, and you can still make out the name Lifesavers. And that's one area where, man, oh man, like if you're in the ocean, like that's gone. You won't see that. And so we're looking at a wreck that's nearly 100 years ago sank, and we can make out details that fine on a wreck. You know, it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Well, T, you were looking at books on the Jones, right? You took photos of the book open and you could read it. And then you did a Google search and found out what the book was, right? That's how much detail you can get.
Yeah. Yeah. Alicia was able to determine the name of the book. So again, all that kind of stuff helps us.
Oh, she's the smart one though, out of our
group.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
She's
yeah.
got the brains and the looks. We're just the dumbasses. Okay. What about the antelope? Where does that fit in?
I didn't make it on the antelope that year.
What?
Me neither.
Are you kidding me?
With me.
You were on the antelope, weren't you? Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I was until you bailed. The antelope's pretty special. I mean, it's got rigging. The masts are still hanging in it. So I don't know where else you could go see a ship like that that still has all of the paint on it. The name is perfectly painted still. It looks like it was painted yesterday. The railing still has green paint on it. The masts are still there. The ropes, it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, it's hard to say what's your favorite, what's the best. That's not a real question there. It's too hard to answer.
I can't answer that. Yeah.
Well, how about this question? What is the oldest wreck that you can dive? And then along with the oldest, what is the newest wreck that you could dive?
Well, I mean, like newest wreck. I mean, I know of a couple like Chris Craft boats that sank 4 or 5 years ago we can go dive. But why would anybody want to do that?
Yeah, probably the most recent one would be the Jodry. So it sank in 1970, 77 or 79, and it was a big freighter. It's actually in the St. Lawrence River, and it lies in 140 to 220 feet of water, and it was a big freighter. It was actually bigger than the Bradley, but it's not technically in the Great Lakes. And so that would be probably the most recent large shipwreck that we would have the opportunity to dive. In terms of the oldest, man, oh, man, I don't know. You know, like you're starting to get into pretty old wrecks on the Ohio, but some of the stuff in Whitefish would be pretty old too. Like it'd be late 1800s.
I mean, we don't know how old Petrie One is, right? But
no,
I bet you that's early 1800s, I bet, looking at it. So,
well, yeah, you got Hamilton and Scourge.
War of 1812.
Yeah, 1812. Yeah.
So those, that's getting back there.
It's kind of hard to say how old, too. So I would say 150, 200 years, right?
Yeah, the Severns went down in 1884. So it's probably the oldest one I've dove, Nick. That'd be probably my oldest one.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
But there's a lot at kind of the turn of the century. Like the stuff up in Whitefish is all late 1800s, early 1900s.
If you go to jefflindsay.ca, you can see all these shipwrecks and what dates they sunk.
Look at him. Punching out his website.
The rest of us haven't set up a website. We let Jeff do that.
Shameless self-promotion.
If you want to see good-looking divers, you're going to see me and Big T in all those photos. All the good photos have us in them.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, well, I'll throw out some, I guess, the last question. As far as, you know, someone that I don't think there's – I mean, maybe there is a good starting point, but someone that's never dove – been diving in the Great Lakes, they want to go and try to, you know, explore that side of it. I'm sure there's plenty of different places to go, but what advice would you give to somebody that is looking to get to the Great Lakes somewhere and try to get a dive in?
I don't know, Bob. I think Milwaukee.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think Milwaukee's good. It's a great base because, you know, whether you're a new diver or new to the Great Lakes, There's wrecks there that will fit every level. If you are coming to the Great Lakes, I highly recommend you're proficient in a dry suit. That's important. You can do it in less, but you're not going to be comfortable and you're not going to enjoy it. You know, you want to wear appropriate gear for that. I think Milwaukee's great. Chicago's decent for the recreational diver, but a lot of those wrecks are more broken up, because Chicago's much shallower down here. But Milwaukee, you can get on a little bit deeper, but still within recreational limits, or run out to some deeper technical dives. I think that's a great way to go.
I think the Straits of Mackinac.
Straits of Mackinac as well. Absolutely.
Yeah, Straits, yeah.
I would recommend the Straits, which is kind of the meeting point between Lake Michigan and Lake Huron.
Which it's hard to believe. You've only got, what, one dive in the Straits.
I've hardly dove there. Just the Uganda and stuff like that, right? Which is not really in the Straits, but...
Uganda and the Cedarville.
In the Cedarville. But there's a lot of shipwrecks, and there's varied depths. And from the little bit I've seen, it's in really good conditions. It's pretty accessible. There's lots of charters in that area. Yeah, so you can kind of dial a depth and do what you want. So
the one last area I would recommend is the St. Lawrence River. Is a really cool spot. So you go as the Lake Ontario will dump into the river, St. Lawrence River, and the St. Lawrence River travels all the way out to the Atlantic. And there's lots of shipwrecks because, of course, that's part of the seaway, you know, that goes up all the way into the lakes. But from Kingston, there's lots of recreational depths, 60 to 100 feet. And then in the river itself, there's, you know, all kinds of variation, right from big freighters to small schooners. You know, that's a cool spot. The other nice thing about the river is in the summertime, that gets quite a bit warmer. And so, you know, that is an area where, you know, in the summertime, July, it's 72 degrees top to bottom in the river. So you can dive that in a 7 mil wetsuit quite easily. And they do promote sport diving in that particular area. So it's a nice spot too. And the area is pretty, you know, you get some cool things to do there.
But T, would you dive in your wetsuit?
Well, T, do you own a wetsuit?
No. I told Nick on my first podcast I used my wetsuit in the shower.
That makes sense.
That's right.
Now we will be using wetsuit and bikini though.
Yes. Yes.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's coming up in May.
Well, I really appreciate you guys coming on to the podcast. This has been awesome. Big T, Hefe, the dude. This has been a great group. So thank you very much for coming on to the podcast and telling me a little bit more about the Great Lakes.
It was great being here.
Thanks a lot, Nick. It's been great speaking with you again.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for having us, Nick.
Offcasting, a scuba podcast.